try to figure out if they know what they have. It's ridiculous. If you find yourself in a game of Engine and see a lot of high cards when you look around, my advice is to bow out immediately. When you bow out, you say, 1, 2, 3, out, and then you bend over and lay your card down on the table so you can't see it until the round is over. People will call you a pussy because if you're out, you don't owe anything. If you stay in and you lose, you owe the pot, which means that you have to match whatever is in the pot when the winner is declared. If there's a grand in the pot when you go up against someone and lose, you pay that out and match that grand to refill the pot. If two guys lose to one guy, each of them owe the pot, so the winner gets his and the pot gets even bigger. That is how the pots get heavy in what is a pretty juvenile game, because even if none of the players are high rollers, things escalate quickly. Say there's $2,000 in there and you beat the last two guys. You get the $2,000, then they put in $2,000 each, making $4,000 the starting pot for the next round. There is a potential for a lot of money to be thrown around, which is exactly what happened to us, because the host of this card game was a pretty smart hustler working a long con. As much as we made fun of him for it, after a few months, we got used to him calling Engine when it was his turn to deal. And once we were used to it, he made his move. One night, the game really got hot, and the pot hit an all-time high of $32,000. He stayed in, he won, and he took it all. The rest of us were floored because that was a lot of money to us. If it were me looking around at the downtrodden faces of my friends, I wouldn't have kept it all. But not him. A couple of the guys took it really hard. They told him flat out that he had completely busted them, and that they would not be able to play cards, go drinking, or do anything but work and stay home for quite a while. It was fucking awkward. But he stood strong. He didn't give a fuck or $1 back. What could we do? We congratulated him. It was gambling, but as much as we loved it, the card game stopped because after that night, we couldn't afford them. It took months for the rest of us to be back in the black and ready for cards again, all of us wanting to win some of our money back from that kid. The games took place at a big round table in his front room. It was a nook surrounded by windows, nothing special, and the way that friends do when they gather to play cards, we always sat in the same seats. Whether it's superstition or tradition, that's card player etiquette when you have a standing game with the same people. That reunion night, however, I sat down in our host's seat. I think he was in the bathroom or something, and it had been a while, so I'd forgotten where I used to sit. It didn't matter anyway, because we hadn't started playing. We always ordered food at the beginning of the night and ate it before we got the cards out. So I was sitting there eating a sub sandwich like a disgusting gutter snipe when I looked up and clear as day saw my reflection in the window looking back at me eating a sub sandwich. I could make out every detail as if it were a mirror. From that distance, I could even see the color of my eyes. Wow, I thought. Isn't that something, you motherfucker? The fucking guy had cheated. He'd scouted out the table, he'd always left the blinds up, and he'd been working us for months. My mind started reeling, trying to figure out how many times he'd won compared to the rest of us. Obviously, the last game stuck out. I dropped my sandwich and got the other guy's attention as quietly as I could. Before he came back in the room, I made a few of them sit there, and we all agreed that if we were sitting there playing Engine and had a card up against our head, we'd be able to see it easily in that window. How do you think that went over? The guy who took home $32,000 knew his card and what he was betting with the entire time. To tell you the truth, as much as it sucked for me, I thought his victory was funny. Who the hell wins $32,000 playing Engine? Two or three of the other guys didn't quite feel the same. They were real Newark Italian kids who didn't take kindly to bullshit. I hadn't known our host for long, but they'd grown up with him and felt completely betrayed and disrespected. They were right, of course. It was a fucked up, insulting thing to do to your friends for the kind of cash that really affected their lives. I watched as everyone in that room realized just how calculated his play had been. The guys who had known him longest wanted to kill him, or at least permanently harm him. The time between me realizing his trick, to me telling everyone about it, to him coming back in the room, happened real fast, so they didn't have time to unanimously decide how severely to injure him. I do remember one kid sitting there, bristling with anger, looking like Psycho from Stripes. "That motherfucker," he said. "I ain't going to jail for killing him, because he ain't worth it. But we need to break fingers. I'm talking 2-3 fingers. Don't you guys worry about it. I'll do it." He returned from the bathroom and found us staring him down like it was a mob meeting and he was the rat, which he was. We confronted him, and he didn't even try to deny it. He put his head down and started crying. He told us how he was down and out because of gambling debts and how he needed the money. That was not a good argument. "We would have loaned it to you, dude," I said. "Why steal from us and make us feel like jerk-offs? You could have slowly paid us back. Instead, you robbed your friends." For months, we'd been calling him a loser for calling Injun. But we were the losers, slowly conned, until the moment of truth when he stayed in with a 2 and took home all our money. We had told everyone we knew the story about this guy's luck and how we were all broke now. As much as we hated him for it, to us, he'd won it fair and square. We liked to gamble, and this was a pretty remarkable gambling story. We were also all friends, so never for a minute did we think that he had fucked us. That night we realized exactly who the guy was and who he always will be. In the early 90s, Colin Quinn used to do a great bit that relates to this. In the old days, stockbrokers were wasps, really blue-blood types. But in the late 80s, as Colin pointed out, things changed. Movies like Boiler Room and The Wolf of Wall Street make it pretty clear that suddenly you didn't need skill, brains, tact, or an education. You just needed balls and the ability to lie like a pro. All you had to do was get your clients to buy stocks because there were no checks and balances. Those illegal boiler rooms became so successful that the best players went legit, and places like Morgan Stanley started hiring guys like the one who used to host the card game. That's what happened to him. No one killed him. No one broke his fingers. But none of us talked to him after that. He lost his friends, he left the port, and he went on to become one of those guys with a phone and a desk in a back-alley New Jersey boiler room. He had the gambling bug worse than any of us, and if you've got it, it's like herpes. You never get rid of it. He was an excellent liar, so he was great at selling crap stocks and was eventually able to make the jump into the legit world as a broker for Morgan Stanley. But, long story short, he ended up being convicted for securities fraud, losing his license, and doing time. I'm not sure the extent of his illegal activity, but I'd bet it was excessive. Because he was the type who couldn't help cheating the system, even when he had it all. He spent just about all the money he'd made that wasn't seized to hire a good lawyer, so in the end, he did less than a year in jail. But he lost his livelihood forever. None of us who played Injun with him were surprised when we read about it in the local paper. It's weird. I've done some pretty depraved things, but I've always maintained a code of honor when it comes to money, which is the only reason I'm not dead or in jail right now. No matter how fucked up I've been, I've always paid the people that count. The government, drug dealers, bookies, hookers, and loan sharks. My old man always said that whatever you do, you have to pay your bills. He was right, because if you do that, nobody fucks with you. If your dope dealer is a good businessman who shows up when he says he will and fronts you when you need him to, then pay him back quickly. Do that, and you'll have no problems. Lucky for me, I became a junkie when I had enough money to cover my debts. I've never been as desperate as the kid who ripped off his friends. The saddest part of the story is that he could have borrowed it from us, or from a Shylock, which would have been better than ripping us off, which was inexcusable. He's still alive today, by the way, and in the AA program. Because all the vices add up, since they all come from the same place. Whatever form it takes, addiction is nothing if not an endless pit of wanting. If you're an addict, no matter how much you have, you always want more. We had so many vices on display at those poker games, it's astonishing. I remember playing Injun, a drink at my side, holding my card to my head with one hand, while bending down to do a line of coke through a bill with the other hand. I'm pretty clumsy and usually got coke on my card, so when I returned to an upright position, the guys would give me shit about wasting drugs. There was so much blow going around that you'd have to specify that you weren't bowing out of the round, you were just doing a line. Of course, some people would bluff. They'd do a line and drop their card or turn it over by mistake while they were doing it and accidentally see it. Yeah, all kinds of bullshit. But even with that, the party givers still scammed us. There were so many ways to fuck with each other and work the game all in good fun. But that kid was brutal. He was always going to be exactly who he was, the guy swindling his buddies by hosting a crooked game of Injun. Chapter 7 My Two Uncles. My Uncle Frank and my Uncle Pat are two of the most hilarious and important figures in my life. My father died when I was 19, so they have been father figures to me ever since. They taught me some very important lessons, mainly not to give a fuck about what anyone thinks, and to be myself. They taught me to risk it all for what I believe in. They also thought I was a complete idiot. My Uncle Frank has been a well-respected member of the Carpenters Union for years. He's one of the pit bosses, telling all the members in his division who to vote for in each election and generally everything else they should be doing with their lives. He's quite the character. I've watched him yell at people but not remember what he's supposed to be telling them to do. I wasn't in his union, but he didn't care. He'd tell me who to vote for to support his cause, and it usually went something like this. Listen, you jerk-off, I've got the fucking list. Here's what you're gonna do for me today. All right, Uncle Frank. What am I doing? Fucking write this down. Vote all this shit is what you're gonna do. You vote Pelucci on number 6. Pelucci and Reggiero. Vote Reggiero. Vote McCallily Reggiero. Who? What do you mean, who? Listen to me. Wait, that's wrong. What the fuck does this paper say? Oh, yeah. Vote Tonelli. That's with a T. Oh, fuck, no, it's Canelli. Canelli with a C, like cunt. Vote Canelli. Vote Frantantoni. Danny Animato, vote him too. Got it, Uncle Frank. I should vote for Steve Animato. No, what's wrong with you? That's his brother. Steve Animato, he's dead. Don't vote him. Don't get us in trouble now. Don't let them see you vote for a dead guy, you fuck. You get caught voting for a dead guy, you'll fuck up the whole thing. Okay, Uncle Frank, I got it. No dead guys. It's Danny Animato. His brother was a great statesman, though, don't you think? You jerk off. You don't think, you do what I tell you to. I used to make extra money doing odd jobs for my uncle, which was great, but also a source of constant aggravation for the both of us. I never seemed to get it right, so he was never happy with me. That never bothered me, because when Uncle Frank was giving me shit, he said some of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. In terms of doing better, this was precisely the wrong type of incentive for me, because it was hard to want to please him when disappointing him was so fucking funny. Take, for example, the time he had me sheetrock the bathroom of an associate's guma. For those who don't know, that's Italian-American slang for a mistress. Artie, you are so stupid, yet you live. I told you to fucking sheetrock my friend's guma's bathroom. It looks like shit. I gotta fucking hear it from him and from her now. Terry Facinieri's bathroom. Did you do Terry Facinieri's bathroom? I did, Uncle Frank. I did it like you told me. Show some fucking respect. The sheetrock is uneven. What the fuck is wrong with you? What, do you got bad eyes? Along with, Artie, you don't fish. You're too fat to fish. Artie, you're so stupid, yet you live, is the funniest thing anyone has ever said to me. My mother said the first. My uncle said the second. That's my family. Here's another conversation Uncle Frank and I had all the time. It involved a guy that Uncle Frank had some kind of feud with. His opponent, the source of his aggravation, would change all the time, but the conversation remained the same. I never knew what the beef was about. All I knew was that Uncle Frank wanted to know what the guy did when I mentioned Uncle Frank's name. This was very, very important to him. Did you go to that job? Yeah. Did you see that guy? Yeah, I saw him. What'd he say? I'd tell him what the guy said. What'd you say? I tell him what I said. What'd he do? I tell him what he did. What'd you do? I tell him what I did. What'd he say when you did that? I tell him what he said when I did that. Fuck him. He's a jerk-off. This started when I was about 17 and would have continued until today if I'd stayed working at the port. Uncle Frank would tell me to go find the guy, whatever guy it was at the time, and he'd tell me exactly what to go and say to the guy. Sometimes it would be just mentioning his name, intended, I assumed, to strike fear in the guy. So I'd go and shout Uncle Frank's name from a distance, and things would get awkward as all these carpenters and longshoremen turned around to look at me, wondering what my fucking problem was. I'd see Uncle Frank a few weeks later, and, as usual, we'd have the same conversation again. You see that guy? What'd he say? Then what'd you say? Then what'd he do? Then what'd you do? Then what did he say when you did that? He's a jerk-off. 6 months later, I'd see him. Come here, asshole. How you been? You see that guy? Every time it was identical. I'd say, Uncle Frank, you realize you're asking about the same guy you asked about the last time I saw you? Oh, Jesus. I'm thinking of your brother. Uncle Frank, I don't have a brother. Shut up. The grill is hot. Go help your mother with the sausages. Even when I started to make up conversations that I'd had with the guy to entertain myself, the conversation remained the same. No matter how far I took it, no matter how absurd or insulting of a remark or action I came up with that the guy had said or done, Uncle Frank always ended up saying the same thing. He's a jerk-off. My Uncle Pat is also one in a million. One year we got him tickets to see Cats on Broadway, which was the biggest show running at the time. After he had seen it, I asked him if he liked it. The fucking play is all about cats, he said. Well, yeah, Uncle Pat. It's called Cats. No, you don't get it. They're dressed like cats. The show is 50 faggots dressed like cats. But that's why they call it Cats. What did you think it was going to be about? I thought it was a symbolic thing. Don't be a jerk-off. There were no dogs in Dog Day Afternoon. I don't think I've ever laughed harder. I told that story to Norm MacDonald, and the same day, he turned around and told it on Letterman, acting like it was his joke. It was blatant plagiarism, but I can't blame him. Uncle Pat is hilarious. Uncle Frank used to claim that he drove the car that carried the guy who carried out the hit on Connie Francis's brother. I have no idea if that was a joke, but I'd always tell him not to tell me anything more about that. Also, here's how he gives directions. Uncle Frank, how do I get there? It's down the shore. I don't know how you get there. You are so stupid. Did you take the retard test? Your mother's very bright. Your sister's very bright. I don't know what's wrong with you. Okay, you want to know where it is? Go down the parkway, make a left, you'll be there. There's a Shine works at the Exxon station. He knows the whole fucking area. Shine, by the way, is a very old-school racist term for an African-American. It's Uncle Frank's preferred racial slur. The other uncle that I learned about comedy from wasn't a blood uncle at all. His name was Sonny, and he was what we call a neighborhood uncle. He was even funnier than Uncle Frank and Uncle Pat, and never realized it. He was so Italian that I'd find him at home with a tomato in one hand and a mozzarella in the other, taking bites from each of them like they were apples. I told a story about him on Letterman, and it was the hardest I've ever made Dave laugh. And to think that I almost didn't tell it. It was my fifth appearance on the show, and the same segment producer, who was a really nice kid, handled me every time I went in. At that point, I was still very intimidated, because I'd been such a huge fan of Letterman for so long. How could I not be? He's the funniest, wittiest guy to do late night in my lifetime. So I told the segment producer the story I'm about to tell you, and he told me not to do it. It's a little offensive, he said. Dave likes to keep it clean. We're not in the old 12:30 time slot anymore. Really? I think he'd like it because it's something my uncle really said, and he likes when people talk about their families, right? I think you should skip it. I told him I would, but when I went on, I did so well that my confidence was at an all-time high. Sitting in that chair with Dave behind his desk, I said fuck it, and decided to go for it. I waited until we were toward the end of my time slot and found some way to crowbar my uncle into whatever we were talking about. I even stopped Dave from going to commercial, which was a huge risk. I saw his eyes roll a little bit as if to say, this had better be good. If the story sucked, my whole appearance would have been a failure and my chance of returning would have been uncertain, because Dave did not suffer fools. So I told Dave about my uncle, who is so Italian that he eats tomatoes and mozzarella like they're apples, and I told him how every once in a while he really surprises me. I told him how one day I went to his house to visit when he was about 83 years old. He has since passed away. And when I came in the room, he shushed me because he was glued to the TV. Uncle Sonny, what are you watching? I asked.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, he said.
Oh, yeah? You like Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Yeah, it's a great show.
Oh, yeah? Uncle Sonny, what's it about?
A Jew broad who fights Draculas.
Letterman completely lost it. He laughed so hard he rolled a fucking chair back. That punchline got such a huge laugh into a solid, long applause break that all he could do was signal to send the show to commercial. He was laughing too hard to say we'll be right back. Once we were off air, he leaned over to me still chuckling and said, that's the funniest fucking thing I've ever heard. The segment producer, who was a little effeminate, came up to me afterward and admitted that it was a great story. That kid was what my Uncle Frank would call flimsy, which was his term for light in the loafers, if you know what I mean.
That guy there is fucking flimsy, man.
He actually once called Flip Wilson a flimsy shine. He was watching Flip Wilson, who, by anyone's standards, was a man's man, in drag, playing his mother in a comedy bit, and he called him a flimsy shine. He didn't recognize Flip, and I'll never forget it. Could there be a more offensive phrase? Think about our world today. With just two words, my uncle successfully marginalized and offended millions of people. Flimsy shine. Such a simple phrase. So full of prejudice and judgment. It's also a great name for a TV show. Aziz Ansari is Flimsy Shine, Wednesdays at 9. Aziz should do it. It would be the funniest thing he ever does. But he never would because he'd lose his audience. They're much too sensitive for something that satirical and sarcastic. He'd go from playing Madison Square Garden to my career. But it would be classic must-see TV. Later on an all-new Flimsy Shine, can Flimsy deal with racism? Next week, Flimsy deals with his worst nightmare, racism, and its ugly cousin, homophobia. Stay tuned. After touring a zoo, Flimsy gets trapped on a bus, stuck in a deadly enclosure, alone with a dead bus driver and one other passenger. That passenger is Flimsy's worst nightmare. He's not only racist, he's homophobic. Don't miss a special episode of Flimsy Shine, starring Aziz Ansari, with special guest Artie Lang as racist homophobe Harry. And later, an all-new Jew broad who fights Draculas. Chapter 8. Keefe for President. I've been playing the Borgata in Atlantic City twice a year since 2006, so the big room there is like a second home to me. It holds 3,500 people, and I always sell it out, sometimes two shows in one night, so the promoters and hotel staff treat me very well. In 2007, I noticed that the Rolling Stones were playing, and the Borgata was a sponsor, so I called my connection down there and made arrangements to bring a girl I was seeing and a couple of friends. They hooked me up with the suite at the hotel, VIP tickets, full rockstar treatment. The Stones were playing the sold-out Atlantic City Convention Center, which holds 15,000 people, and I couldn't wait because, along with Springsteen, the Stones are my favorite rock and roll band. We got down to the hotel, checked in, and when it was showtime, a concierge brought us through a back entrance directly to the VIP seats, which were in the front rows, less than 10 feet from the stage. I was even more excited because I knew we were on Keith Richards' side. Directly in front of us, I noticed one of the kids from That 70s Show, who isn't Ashton Kutcher, sitting with one of the Olsen twins. I believe the one with two names, but who can really tell? They were smoking a joint, which they shared with us, and it was some of the strongest weed I've ever smoked in my life. It hit me immediately. So, as I sat there trying to act casual, inside I was freaking out. With my mind reeling, I kept looking at this teeny tiny waif of a girl with a giant handbag, puffing away at this thing like it was a Marlboro Light, while I,
The notorious drug addict had a silent panic attack after one hit. I lit a cigarette to try to calm down and thought about how much I love the Stones, especially Keith Richards. He has seen it all, done it all, and he keeps going, pushing the envelope well into his 70s. All my favorite artists, from John Belushi to Richard Pryor, attacked their art the way they lived their lives. They never played it safe, and they took no quarter. And Keith Richards is, "Excuse me, sir, you can't smoke here." The epitome of, "Sir, you deaf? You can't smoke here." I turned around to find a security guard who was Puerto Rican and in his mid-30s, staring at me. "Listen, Artie, I'm sorry about this, but you can't smoke in here," he said. "Come on, man, are you serious?" The smoke from Olson's joint was still hanging over her like Los Angeles smog, but he was giving me shit? "I know these are VIP seats, but everyone is looking at you. This is my section, and it's my ass if somebody sees you smoking and word gets back to my supervisor." "I hear you, but listen, I really need a cigarette," I said, hoping that a sympathy play would win him over. It didn't, because they never do.
"No one can smoke in here anymore, man. The fucking president can't smoke if he comes here to watch a show."
Through the strong stench of weed, I caught a distinct whiff of bullshit. "You mean to tell me that if the president of the United States was here, he wouldn't be able to smoke?"
"That's right. Those are the rules."
"You mean to tell me that Keith Richards isn't going to be allowed to have a cigarette while he's on stage playing tonight?"
"Nope, not even him."
The guy proceeded to explain in a very long-winded fashion how everyone in the Rolling Stones camp was told that under no circumstances were they to smoke on stage. This was ridiculous because anyone who has ever seen the Stones knows that both Keith and Ronnie Wood smoke while they're on stage. A cigarette is part of Keith's gear. It's synonymous with him the way big sunglasses are synonymous with Bono. It would shock fans if he didn't light up during a show. "So let me get this straight," I said. "Neither Keith Richards or Ronnie Wood are gonna have a cigarette the entire time they're on stage?"
"Nope."
"Neither of them?"
"Nope."
"Are you a gambling man?" I asked.
"Definitely. I also work for the casino, you know."
"Well, I bet you $1,000 that Keith Richards has a cigarette while he's playing tonight."
"You're on," he said. "I don't give a shit if you're a VIP, Artie. I'll take your money."
"You got it on you? Because I've got it on me."
"No, but I can get it back at the hotel."
"All right then, man. You're on." As if the night couldn't get better, now I had some action going. Action gives meaning to a degenerate gambler's life. It brings excitement to things that are otherwise dull and boring, and it makes exciting things even more of a thrill. In this case, it added excitement to something that was already exciting. That's a win-win. I was kidding with the security guard at first, but his smug confidence and obvious lack of knowledge when it came to the Rolling Stones pissed me off. It became personal, and I could tell that I'd had the same effect on him. Deep down, he knew the rules were bullshit, but it was his job to uphold them, so it became personal for him, too. And once we had action going, everything changed, because that's what action does. It became me versus him. So if he didn't like me before, he really didn't like me once we had money on the line. "Artie, just let it go," my date said. "This is awkward now." "Why? We have a bet going. Don't you want to see what happens? I do." "Look at him. He looks really pissed off, Artie," she said. "Why does everything you do have to be so crazy? Nothing can ever be relaxing." She was right. It was awkward, but that's just the way I'm wired. And she hadn't quite figured that out yet. We were past the point of having a reasonable conversation about it, so now I just wanted to win the bet and teach the guy a lesson. It was the cherry on the sundae for me that night. If my life were a movie, I'd have enjoyed a million happy endings by now. But it's not. My life continues against the odds, so I have to find ways to keep it exciting. Otherwise, I'll die of boredom, wondering what's going to happen next. What should I do? Sit around eating egg white omelets and gluten-free muffins for the rest of my life? Fuck that. I need action. Because there isn't anything in the world that can't be made more interesting with the addition of a little action. The lights went down, the crowd roared, and the opening riff of Satisfaction reverberated through the hall. As the lights came up, A spotlight shone on Keith, who was standing directly in front of me. There he stood, in a circle of light, hunched over, laying down that classic guitar line, with a lit Marlboro Red 100 in his mouth as a thick blue cloud of smoke curled around his head. I looked over at the guard and smiled. The guy looked like he wanted to kill me.
"I'll give you the fucking money at the hotel," he yelled.
He was so mad that he moved to another part of the section so he didn't have to see me. I was positive that I'd never see him again, and that was fine. I'd won the bet and proven a point. Two things that mattered more to me than the $1,000. I'd also earned the right to smoke, which I did whenever I wanted for the rest of the concert. After the show, we went back to the Borgata, and after hanging out in the suite for a bit, my girl and I went downstairs to play craps. Norm MacDonald has taught me his system for playing craps, and that night I wanted to give it a shot. Norm always plays the don't pass line, which means you're betting against the rollers, so you win when they roll a seven or crap out. A lot of people consider that taboo or in bad taste, and a lot of gamblers call it playing the dark side, because you win when the other players lose. It's very Norm. He'd be winning, doubling his bets, and celebrating as the rollers continue to lose. You need a big bankroll to play this system because you can lose a lot of money in a hurry, but as Norm always says, when it comes to gambling, you gotta lose money to make money. Norm always counted on losing, but at some point in the night going on a big run that would put him ahead. We'd been down there for about 4 hours when the security guard found me at the tables. I didn't recognize him in his street clothes, and to be honest, I'd forgotten all about him. "Here's your money, asshole," he said, and he grinned. "Come on, man, don't worry about it," I said. "I don't want to take your money." I really didn't. He could not be making that much as a security guard. He was just a regular, hard-working guy. "Take it," he said. "I'm not a Welsher." I respected that. Growing up in Jersey, you were only as good as your word, especially when it came to betting. It didn't matter if you were drunk or sober. Betting on a big game or how many wings you could eat in a minute, when you lost, you paid up, no matter what. I didn't want to disrespect him, so I took his money. By that point, I was going to call it a night. Plus, my girl wanted to go up to the room, but when this guy came along with $1,000, I insisted on staying. "It's free money. I've got to try to win something with this. It's a good omen." I told the guard to stay and play craps with me, which he did. I was using Norm's system, but wasn't having much luck with it. I wasn't even winning enough to double my bets and start a run, so I kept betting more and more, hoping to fill out my bankroll. I had the guard roll for me and put $5,000 on the don't pass. His first roll, the dice came up 7. Fuck me. I put another $5,000 down and had him roll again. He rolled another 7. That sucked, but no problem. I put another $5,000 down because what were the odds that this goon would roll 7s 3 times in a row? Slim to none. He rolled the dice. Another 7. I couldn't fucking believe it. 4 minutes. 3 straight 7s. $15,000 gone. It was one of those nights, but since I'm a degenerate gambler, I couldn't let it go. At one point, I ran out of cash and had to get an advance on my Amex Platinum card. They did that right at the table for me. The pit boss came over with the paperwork, I signed it, and they brought me the money. It's like getting a bank loan, but cooler, because a broad with her tits hanging out brought me free drinks the whole time. Back when I was on Stern and playing casinos in Vegas and Atlantic City many times a year, they used to ask me if I wanted to be paid in cash or in credit for the tables. That's how bad I used to be. This night was like a flashback to those days, because I was busted, but I wasn't ready to quit. And I didn't quit until I was $26,400 in the hole. The security guard stayed and watched the whole thing, because he might have lost $1,000, but he won his boss's $26,400. "You really should get a cut of that," I told him when I finally tore myself away. For all my trouble, the casino comped me a steak dinner at the all-night restaurant. I wasn't even hungry, but there was no way in hell that I wasn't going to eat that fucking steak. My girl thought the whole thing was pathetic.
How can you say that? I asked.
Go to bed if you want.
But don't you want to know what a $26,400 steak tastes like?
Chapter 9. Digging a Hole.
I've appeared on Late Night with David Letterman 12 times. I've gone on and absolutely killed, and the first time I did so was one of the greatest feelings I've ever known. But I kept going back, so soon enough I knew exactly what type of story to tell and which comments would play best off Dave. Killing on Letterman became second nature to me, until eventually I had this conversation with myself in the green room about an hour before an appearance.
Letterman again. Man, it doesn't get any better than this. But what's different this time?
Well, the last time I was here, I did not have a big bag of Coke in my pocket.
Hey, maybe I should do some now, right here in the green room.
I can't be the first person to do that.
Actually, why haven't I done that by now?
Jesus Christ, what else do I have to offer them that isn't just Artie again?
Know what? I need to do some cocaine before this appearance. Dave's audience knows what they're in for with me. I've got to be old news to them by now. If I show them a different Artie that's new, and they haven't seen Cocaine Artie live on Dave yet, let's think about this. If I do some of the coke, I'll look agitated and high on drugs. That will get ratings. Maybe a page six item. That I can do. But let's think bigger. What if I do the entire bag? I'll look insane, and that would really be something. I could fuck up badly, or I could kill. If I do the entire eight ball in the next 10 minutes, I'll be so high that who knows what will happen. I might even insult Dave and not even realize it. If I do it all, I might bomb and completely ruin my career. Obviously, I went for it. It wasn't my best show, and I wasn't asked back for a while, but fuck, my minutes in the chair sure were exciting. This behavior doesn't stop when I'm off drugs, by the way. A layman might think it would, but anyone who knows addiction understands that the drive doesn't go away. It just changes forms as you eliminate the need. After I got sober, I did Letterman again, and instead of doing cocaine, I ate Twinkies. Because there is nothing like a cheap sugar high when you've got type 2 diabetes. You take down a handful of Twinkies, and all the corn syrup and chemicals will get you just as lightheaded and dopey. And if you take it too far and you're as fat as I am, you'll pass out. When I'm sober, if I don't have an insulin shot with me, I can get momentarily high at any craft service table. That is what you do when you go to any length to make things spontaneous and unpredictable, because that is all you look forward to in life. My definition of gambling is making a choice to defy the comfort zone at all costs. And what I've realized is that my favorite bets involve betting with things I can't replace, like my health, my profession, and my relationships. That's the real deal. If you're like me, those are the bets that make you feel most alive. In that arena, innocent junk food consumed might blow your house of cards down or, conversely, reaffirm your confidence for months to come. Being unsafe like that serves to handicap me so that I can see whether or not I'm still talented enough to haul myself out of the holes I dig for myself. If I can't come from behind and win, I've lost my edge. I'm not alone in playing this twisted game. Any comic worth seeing more than once tests themselves, but only the best tempt fate like this. How do you think we get so good at fucking with you people? We start by hating ourselves first and foremost. They say you can't really love someone until you learn to love yourself. Well, let me tell you, the same goes for hate. I can tell you exactly when I learned to feed that self-loathing into my act. I was still terrible at stand-up comedy, but I wasn't going to quit because my mother had granted me that second chance. Once I left the port and started driving a cab so that I could get into the city, I started getting up wherever they'd have me. One of the many places, and a personal favorite, was CBGB's Gallery. That was the art and performance space next door to the legendary concert venue, and in keeping with the spirit of CB's, anything with attitude was welcome. So I managed to get myself some time. I don't even remember how.
But all that I needed to get me in gear was the knowledge that I was going to do a few minutes of comedy in a room somehow related to the Ramones and all the great punk bands that had inspired me so much. They'd all played next door, so for me, 2 minutes in the basement adjacent to that was a dream come true. The vibe in the gallery was still punk rock, and I loved that. Every comic who got up had 2 minutes to sink or swim, and the crowd really let you know how you were doing. Whatever I was spewing worked well enough that they gave me time regularly every Tuesday night. That was my first paying gig in comedy. And I still think it's cool that CBGB's was the first venue in the city that actually paid me to show up. There were other perks to the gig as well. Like the pharmaceutical-grade coke the sound guy got from Dee Dee Ramone one night. Maybe he was lying, but holy shit, if he wasn't, I have no idea how Dee Dee or any of them lived day to day. I snorted a few lines and walked off into the night high as a kite. I had a ton of energy, so I kept walking and walking all the way to the Port Authority, some 60 blocks to the northwest. It felt like I got there in 5 minutes. Those early days, wandering around with everything to lose, trying to make a go of my dream, made me who I am. I experienced liberation when it worked, dread when it didn't, but it was exactly where I wanted to be. During this period of time, I learned who I am, because it's when I learned that I'm funny. It took me years to achieve the command of stand-up that I have now. Working up a new hour of material is a process that starts months before it gets to an audience. I test bits here and there and refine them until it all hangs together. I go over everything until I think it's great. So once I'm on tour, doing some version of the same hour every night, it's yesterday's news to me. That doesn't mean I don't enjoy it, it just means that I'm used to it, which leaves room for boredom. And when that happens, I dig a hole. I'm not special. That is what all good comics do to keep themselves at the top of their game. When you're working on new material and you're not sure if it's good, get a shovel and start digging. You'll find out soon enough. Digging myself into a hole on stage is the creative jolt I have to have. One of my favorite exercises is showing up unannounced at the Comedy Cellar in New York. And if he's around, sometimes Dave Attell will come with me. We'll arrive at 1 or 2 a.m. on a weekend when all the tourists and college kids are drunk, and we make fun of each other, ourselves, and everyone in the audience until every last person gets up and leaves. It's a great time. I've cleared rooms, but Dave Attell is a master who can clear a room as easily as he can fill it. His true brilliance is doing both in the same set, which is the ultimate comedy high, in my opinion. Deciding to do that is like taking action on your own set, and you know how I feel about taking action. My friend Nick DiPaolo, who is angry and hates himself more than anyone I know, enjoys going all in as well. He and I did a tour together a few years ago, and the second we got bored of killing night after night, we started playing a little game. Once you know which jokes in your set work every time, you consider those your safe material. They don't need pacing. They don't need a long setup. Pull them out at any time, and you'll get your laughs. The unsafe stuff is what you want to focus on because it's still raw, and you don't know how it's going to do. That's the problem with younger comedians nowadays. They're all cowards who are afraid to fail. They work out a safe set of material that does not offend, and they stick to it like a script. They've missed the point because the only way you get better is by failing. They don't understand that because they're spineless PC zombies who were raised on selfies. It doesn't make any sense to me because young people are so easy to offend, but at the same time, they can't be shocked. Thanks to the internet, they've seen everything and are incredibly blasé about out there shit. But if you make them deal with something in real life, they get offended. If you force them to think about things and put those things in their faces, they get traumatized and horrified because they can't handle it. On most college campuses, all I have to say is Bruce Jenner as a pussy, and the crowd will go nuts, and not in a good way. To them, Bruce Jenner is the face of transgender identity politics. To me, he's the guy who won the decathlon at the 1976 Olympics. Big difference. You're telling me that the guy with the gold medal that used to be on my Wheaties box when I was a kid has a pussy? I need a couple of seconds to adjust to that information. A 60-year-old guy gets a pussy, and the next day causes a pileup on the highway. I don't think that was a coincidence. Talk about distracted driving. I think he was playing with his new pussy.
What male cop wouldn't understand that?
You killed 9 people, Bruce. I just got a pussy.
No shit.
You're free to go. When I do that one, the kids are shocked, and the women are appalled. But it's gotten to the point where I've begun to enjoy pissing people off more than I enjoy making them laugh, which is another way of gambling with my career. The stranger and grosser I go with a bit, the more fun I have, because everyone is too fucking sensitive. This generation's Clint Eastwood is Neil Patrick Harris, a gay guy who plays a womanizer on TV. Need I say more? A lot of my comedy isn't about telling jokes. It's about giving people a jolt, which is a lot riskier. And that's why I love it. Testing new material is like juggling with chainsaws for the first time. You could die, or you could do the impossible and pull off a trick they'll never forget. I don't believe in focus groups or dress rehearsals. I believe in delivering the product to the consumers directly to see if they like it. New stuff might bomb, but if you don't have the balls to bomb, you shouldn't be on a stage. You should be in the audience. These young comics today have a 7-minute set that they've worked on for months or years even. They know it kills, and it's exactly what they'll use if they ever get a spot on a talk show. That set will be clean, it will show the world who they are, and in their minds, it might get them a Seinfeld sitcom. To them, I say, whatever, losers. Unfriend me on Facebook. Those comedians would never dream of digging a hole the way I do. Keep in mind that I consider this fun. I'll get on stage and in the first few minutes say something intended to completely lose me the audience. It is so intentionally offensive on such an unexpected level that instantly I'm standing up there alone at the bottom of a 50-foot pit. That's comforting to me because from there, I know my job. To spend the rest of the set climbing out. I try to find a way to win them back, and if it works, by the end, I still kill. It's a wild ride, but it doesn't always end well, because sometimes the hole is too deep, and my new material isn't strong enough to win the day. Anyway, I do this by saying the worst thing I can think of as soon as I take the stage. My go-to is always the N-word, but as bad as saying that is, it isn't enough of a shock. So I go further. I say the N-word in a way that it isn't part of a joke. I make it part of me telling a story as if it just so happened to be the word I chose. I say it in a way that is so blatantly racist that it makes everyone instantly uncomfortable. Here's an example. I'm sorry I'm late tonight, guys, but on the way here a nigger cut me off. Another scheme of mine is to tell a truly offensive joke and keep making mistakes telling it, so I end up repeating racial epithets until it gets awkward. That one goes something like this. So, my uncle told me this joke the other day. 2 spicks and a nigger walk into a bar. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. It's 3 spicks and 1 nigger. Okay, wait. That's not it. It's 3 niggers and a Jew. No, wait. Is it 4 niggers? No. It's 4 spicks and a filthy kike. That's what it is. No, wait. It's 1 filthy kike, 3 guineas, and a nigger that walk into a bar. Wait, 4 niggers and, know what? I'll get back to that one. A few years ago, when I toured with Dave Attell and Nick DiPaolo, some nights the 3 of us would all dig holes to see who climbed out best. I'd do the joke I just told and try not to laugh listening to those 2 offstage guffawing while a room of uptight people somewhere in Indiana looked at me like I was up there raping someone's grandmother. The gag is that I always eventually abandon the joke, but how long I keep it going depends on how deep a hole I'm after. Some nights I've gone on for quite a while, well past the point of the last uneasy laughs. On those nights when I say, never mind, I'll get back to that one, the crowd looks even more horrified. They've just sat through 3 minutes of racist non sequiturs and got no payoff. Other nights, I set the whole thing up as a tribute to my uncle, who never shies away from a racist joke, by the way. Hey guys, it's my uncle's birthday today, so allow me to tell this corny, old-fashioned joke of his. He has told our family this joke around the table every Christmas for as long as I can remember. And then I'd break ground with my shovel and let the indignities fly. Sometimes I feel the need to take it even further than that. Hey, so my mother told me this joke today, and my mother, she is such a card. She loves this joke. Four niggers are fucking a monkey. No, wait. Four monkeys are fucking a nigger. Wait, I'm sorry. This is my mother's joke, so the monkeys are the niggers in this one. Three kikes are fucking four niggers and a monkey, which, if you think about it, is really five niggers, right? I think that's how she tells it. No, wait. Maybe it's three guineas? You know, I am a guinea, so I'm allowed to say that. Anyway, three niggers, a wop, and four kikes are... You know what? I'll get back to it. I can't remember how it goes. No matter how far that gets me from any kind of connection with the audience, it's not enough. I wait until the room is nice and awkwardly silent, then I say something innocuous. Anybody here have a CD player? Because mine's on the fritz. I think I need a new one. Anyone here ever been to an airport? I mean, come on, right? Following up racism with the cleanest, most unoriginal comedy bit I can think of always seals the deal. How could it not? What audience wouldn't be wondering where else they could be that night after several minutes of racist slurs, followed by, how about those airlines? They're crazy! On that tour with Attell and DePaulo, I was famously the one who dug the deepest hole every night, and my batting average for getting out of it was pretty good. That tour was creative and inspiring because the three of us tried out new material and approached each audience differently. We had to be at the top of our game, or else we'd fail because we'd started by alienating the crowd. This used to be a more widespread practice in the stand-up comedy world, but nowadays, thanks to cell phones, people pussy out since everything gets recorded. Put it this way. If Michael Richards wasn't captured by audience members' cell phone cameras, his career would have gone on, because he would have been able to dispute it. Sure, the people that were there that night would stand by what they saw, but without footage, there would be doubt. He would have been able to say that he didn't do it, or say that they were taking his comments out of context. He could say the whole thing was a bit and that his accusers didn't get it, or that they were just crazy and exaggerating. Hell, without video, he could even say, sure, I said nigger, but I didn't say it eight times. Who does that? Even if he admitted it in that way, I think people would have bought it. When you're a celebrity, especially one who played such a beloved character, people want to believe you. But unfortunately, you can't refute footage from multiple sources at the scene. When people see something on tape, you're done. They decide for themselves no matter what you say. Which reminds me of another joke I've used to dig myself into a hole at the start of a set. This one isn't a sure thing because it paints such a funny picture that it always gets a handful of uncomfortable laughs. It's an awkward one, but it's a good joke on its own. I love this joke, so I do it as a regular bit in my act on nights and in clubs where I feel comfortable, because it's not for everyone or every audience. It's the kind of joke that kills in Boston around midnight, which, if you haven't been there, is a lot like being at a Ku Klux Klan meeting. Here it is. How great would it have been if nigger was Kramer's catchphrase? Think about it. If every time he did one of those crazy entrances, his catchphrase was nigger.
Oh, I hope Kramer doesn't show up.
Uh-huh. Nigger. Jerry and George would be in Jerry's apartment talking and be interrupted by Kramer sliding through the door yelling, nigger? That would have been great. Has anybody seen Kramer?
Nigger.
Here I am, Jerry. It's too bad. If Kramer's catchphrase had been nigger, Michael Richards would still have a career. Digging a hole is a risk, but I see it as necessity. It's what I have to do when stand-up gets boring, because the minute you're complacent doing stand-up comedy is the minute you're through. You have to remain prolific, and you can never rest on your laurels or rely solely on your tried-and-true stuff. You have to be able to read the crowd and adjust accordingly. No matter who they are, you have to find a way to grab their attention and take them with you wherever you want to go. A great act takes timing, good material, and the ability to read the crowd. To continue to be good, you have to stay sharp and be resourceful. George Carlin wrote 40 fucking hours of stand-up, which is insane. I have shot 3 one-hour specials, which I'm proud of, since a lot of people stop after they've done just one. I don't plan on slowing down. In fact, I'm working on my next one. On top of the books, my podcast, and whatever TV I do, I will always write stand-up because I love it the most. And why wouldn't I? If you approach it the way I do, stand-up is a gamble and a thrill ride every time. Stand-up is also the only risk I'm paid to take. At this point in my life, I get up there and I've got nothing to prove. I've lived through enough crazy shit that even if I were a dimwit comic, I could get on stage and entertain people just by telling stories for a few minutes. Doing it well is a gift because being funny is a very powerful thing. In social circles, the funniest person commands the room. It isn't the richest man or the best-looking woman. It's the funniest person who has control over everyone. If you can make people laugh, you can make people listen to you. If you are truly funny, you will end up at the front of the line. People like being around funny people because humor makes everyone feel smarter and more alive. As a comic, when we get on stage, it's an acknowledgement from the world that we are so funny and so interesting that people who don't even know us are willing to pay money to hear what we have to say. Think about that for a moment. We do. And that's why once we have fans, we feel the pressure to always be good and to keep getting better. Fans are invaluable to a comic because they both encourage and challenge us. Good audiences at a comedy club have an energy that we can feel. Okay, motherfucker. So you think you're funny? Well, be funny. Show me what you got. That's the attitude of a good audience and that vibe that feeds us. Doing stand-up is walking a tightrope strung up by your ego, and every joke that works is one step farther across the abyss of your insecurity and self-loathing. When you get the balance right, you're invincible. I've slept with women so far out of my league because they just seen me kill. That kind of success is immediate power. If I bomb, the same woman will never fuck me because even if she sees me kill the very next night, the stench of failure will always be on me. If everything goes right, I'm Warren Beatty in the 70s. If it doesn't, I'm a midget with syphilis. I love offending people. I love wandering out there on the edge because I love chance. I love bets where the odds are 50-50, like telling a joke with no clue as to how the audience will react. When I do that, I'm proud because it reminds me of why I'm doing this in the first place. It reminds me of the first time I heard a Richard Pryor album. Pryor did not give a fuck, ever. He talked about everything that people were scared of at the time. Racism, drug use, and police oppression. That was 40 years ago, by the way, which says a lot about how much we've grown as a society. Pryor was, to say the least, ahead of his time. He talked about those aspects of our society in a way that was so raw that I felt like I'd get arrested for just listening to him. That is what comedy should be like. Comics should speak the truth while offending every single person in sight. If you don't believe me, here's an example. In 2004, I was playing the Aspen Laugh Festival, and at the time, I was still very much off the wagon. I did a set at 1 a.m., and at that hour, a festival crowd is the real deal. Comedy writers, comics, and agents. At the time, my manager, who is no longer my manager, but not because of anything that happened that night, was trying to close a deal for me to do a comedy special with HBO. There were a lot of influential people from the network there, including Michael Patrick King, the executive producer, writer, and figurehead of Sex and the City. Whatever you might think of that show, it was an HBO institution, and in 2004... was in the midst of a popular and successful final season after 6 years. My former manager knew that Michael Patrick King was in the audience and told me to tone it down and play it safe. His reasoning was that we were on the verge of selling the special and that
I could do whatever I wanted to after that, but until then, I should keep it on the level. As an extremely heterosexual former longshoreman from New Jersey, even I knew that Sex and the City was written by the gayest men alive, so I did a set that revolved around one question. Am I homophobic? I haven't done it in a while, but